Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast, originally recorded in 1998, is with the late Dr. Christian DeDuve, 1974 Nobel Prize winner, and Bob Chittister, founder of the Free to Choose Network. We hope you enjoy today's podcast, and don't forget to subscribe to get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Professor DeDuve, in the Vital Dust, I read in the preface your explanation of this dream that you had as a medical student, I believe, and your dream to understand the truth. I'd like you to tell me more about that dream. Give me more detail about that.
Well, you know, I spent most of my life in Belgium. I was born in England, but I went to school in Belgium. My parents were Belgians. I'm a Belgian national, and so I attended a Jesuit school when I was a child, and so they were very good at ancient languages, Latin and Greek. They were very good at philosophy, very good at mathematics. Also, of course, modern languages. I learned French and English and Flemish, German. They were very poor at science. And so when I was a child, I was attracted mostly, I would say, by maybe philosophy and mathematics. I mean, and so the mystery of the universe was something that I was concerned with when I was a child. But when I had to choose what kind of subject I was going to study in university, I had some problems because, you know, philosophy didn't sort of lead to any sort of career that I could think of, and I wasn't too interested in the careers that were offered by the humanities, like law. My father was a lawyer, and so in my family there was a tradition of law, but that didn't attract me, and so business didn't attract me too much. And so finally I was attracted by medicine, mostly because I was attracted by the romantic part of it, you know, the man in white who's taking care of suffering humanity and so on. And so that attracted me. I was a romantic youth.
But you never practiced medicine ultimately,
well,
right?
I did a little.
All right.
But and so when I decided to become a physician, I said, well, okay, I have to learn chemistry and physics and biology, but that's just the two or three first years. I'll go through that, and then after that I can really devote myself to medicine. And so, but as a medical student, I had some free time, and so this was a tradition with quote unquote good students. They would spend some time as a free assistant in some research lab. And so I went into a physiology research lab as a student and started doing experiments under the supervision, of course, of a professor. And in less than a year, I was hooked. Suddenly, I discovered science, and I discovered that the scientific approach. I discovered that my vague dream of you know sometime
I was figuring it all out.
Right. I found well this is the way to do it, because here you are approaching the truth in a systematic fashion, in a fashion that can be controlled by experiment. You can find out whether you're right or wrong and so on, whether you're on the... And so I said, this is intellectually, because I was basically a Cartesian, this was intellectually satisfactory. And then I found it exciting, you know, to just the physical pleasure of doing experiments.
Seeing results, seeing something happen.
So, mm-hmm. So I was hooked, and in fact, it took me a little effort to complete my medical training, because I decided I was going to be a scientist, and so why should I learn, you know, ear, nose, and throat diseases and whatever. But I did, and then that when I graduated, the war had started. There was a brief interlude in which I was involved, but fortunately I was able to to escape and to go back to my studies, even under the German occupation. And so by that time, that was 1941, I was an MD, I wasn't going to practice, I was going to do research, and I was interested in a problem that was mostly dealing with insulin, diabetes. Yes. And I wanted to find out how insulin works. And then I decided, well, I can't find an answer to this question with the kind of training that I have. This is going to be a chemical problem. And so I have to learn chemistry. I have to become a biochemist and not just a sort of physician, physiologist. So I went back to school.
And that was during the war? You were
during
back
the war. So I went back to school and studied chemistry. But at that time, of course, I had to support myself to some extent. And also my mentor, my teacher, told me, well, you know, there's no future for you. And there was. There's little future in academic life in Belgium at that time, unless you were the son of a professor. And so he said, there's no future for you. Your chair of biochemistry is already filled in. And so I think you should remember that you are a physician, because that's the only way you probably will earn your living. And so I think you should do a little more training. But I wanted to combine training, this kind of training, with doing my chemistry studies, which was, in fact, doing two jobs in one at one time. And I was very fortunate in finding a remarkable man who was the head of the Cancer Institute at my university in Louvain, in Belgium. And he was really a great man. He was the first president of the International Union of Cancer, so he was really an internationally known scientist and cancer specialist. And when he had a position open for an assistant, I said, well, I'd like to have that position, but I should tell you that in the daytime, I'm going to study chemistry. And he didn't throw me out. He said, that's a wonderful idea. He said, medicine and chemistry, that's ideal marriage.
Yes.
And so he took me in, and I did a lot of work in the evening for his patients and so on. So I did really.
So you did practice some medicine.
I did practice. I took care of cancer patients for 3 years, yes, mm-hmm. yes. But in the daytime, I was doing a lot of.
Which interestingly would have. Have you ever, has that had any contribution, because you've been so involved with work with cells, et cetera, which of course is the whole thing with cancer and how the cell behaves. Have you ever felt that there was any, that you gained anything out of the firsthand awareness of the disease?
I think I gained a lot by an initial training as an MD, as a physician, because it gave me a sort of superficial but wide view of possible problems, of biology in general. And then, of course, when I went deep, it was first biochemistry and then somewhat by accident cell biology. But I didn't have tunnel vision, which I might have if I had immediately started becoming, let's say, a molecular biologist and didn't know anything about anything else. And I was quite involved at one time in developing new chemotherapeutic agents against cancer. And in the institute that I started in Belgium, a lot of work is going on cancer. So, yeah.
I have I want to go back to your original dream.
Please.
Because where did you derive, I don't mean this unkindly, I mean, where did you derive the sense of confidence that you could really do some breakthroughs? In other words, to say, boy, I'm going to try to understand what the universe is all about is a pretty ambitious.
Well, I guess I was fairly confident when I was a child. I was, excuse my being immodest, but I was a very bright kid. I was always head of my class at school, and I studied without any difficulty. I went through, you know, without.
You enjoyed
really,
studying also?
I enjoyed it. I hated memorizing things. I never had a very good memory for that kind of thing. So history, I wasn't attracted by at all, because I had to memorize dates and kingdoms and things of that kind, dynasties. That I found boring. Geography, to some extent, I found boring. Anything that really required just memorizing. And even during my studies, there were a number of branches that I didn't enjoy learning. But what I did enjoy was any kind of intellectual game, that, using my brain. And I still do today, and it doesn't matter what. You know, I can enjoy doing a crossword puzzle or playing Scrabble or bridge or whatever, if just I can.
Yes, it requires you to figure something
juggle,
out.
Juggle ideas. That's been, and that when I was a child, I loved problems, you know. The things that other children hated, I loved.
Did you also, because you said you attended a Jesuit school, did you engage at all in discussions of religion and the challenge of understanding science, religion,
at that time, I must say, at that time, I wasn't really questioning. I just accepted. They were very good teachers, and you know they had the truth, and I didn't really at that time question it, because I hadn't really yet acquired the scientific spirit and the spirit of skepticism and of critical analysis. You know, so I. But I was, of course, I was fairly religious when I was a child. So I was attracted by the mystery. I was attracted by the outdoors. I was a Boy Scout and did a lot of camping and hiking and so on. And so, you know, you sit around a campfire at night and you sing and you look at the stars and all that. I mean, when you were 16, it's all registers. And so that was the great mystery of life, you know. But it was all rather superficial and romantic. I mean, the way young children are.
You, in the book, you reference the fact that you came to, if I understand correctly, a conclusion that one of the ways you could seek truth was through understanding of life.
Mm-hmm.
And what led to that revelation? And I mean, another way to go, in fact, in a certain sense, more obvious way it seems to me to go would be your. If you're out watching campfires and say the stars, well, gee, I'm going to study physics and astronomy and things like that. But you chose not to. You chose to pursue the path of living.
That's accident. You should get away with the idea that I spent all my life thinking about the great mysteries. I forgot about the great mysteries as soon as I started doing laboratory work, because then I became involved with small local mysteries, you know, why does this little thing act the way it does and not differently, and things like that. So I became more and more involved with the problems that I was investigating.
But you did choose to go in a certain way within science. You chose chemistry, biology.
Well, you know,
was that purposeful or was that accidental?
Well, to some extent it was accidental, because I'd chosen medicine to start with. So medicine was my introduction to biology. And so naturally I became interested in biology, because that was the science I was exposed to, biology and then chemistry. And so biochemistry became my thing. And the biochemistry was the discipline that I practiced all my life, because I'm supposed to be a cell biologist, but that is accident. I became a cell biologist by accident, and I discovered parts of the cell without ever looking at them. It was all using analytical techniques, chemical techniques, centrifugation, separation techniques, whereby I would separate parts of the cell from each other, and then when I had them sufficiently purified, I would use all the tools of chemistry to find out what they were. And so I discovered a cell part which I call the lysosome, which is the stomach of the cell. Well, looking at it, of course, afterwards I was able to see it in the microscope and in the electron microscope and see how it looked like. But by the time I had called it the lysosome, I'd never seen it. It was something that I had in a test tube, and it was a bag that behaved in a certain way. It had a membrane around because of some experiments that I'd done. I knew that without looking at it again. And then inside that bag, I found all kinds of enzymes that happen to be digestive enzymes. That is the kind of enzymes you have in your stomach, in your intestinal tract. And so I concluded, well, a bag containing those enzymes can do nothing but digest. So this is the stomach of the cell. And lysosome is simply Greek for the cell stomach.
Cell stomach. There's an interesting analogy that in physics, we have the theoretical physicists who never look through a telescope or do any kind of reconstruction, and yet they do the, in a sense, you were doing the same thing. You were kind of being a theoretical biologist.
No, because theoretical biologists, they do it all in their heads,
and
they use computers.
Head. Yes, yes.
I was not at all. I was a chemist.
You're a chemist.
I was analyzing cells by means of physical and chemical techniques, but not visual techniques. And in fact, my Nobel lecture is called Exploring Cells with a Centrifuge, because that was the instrument that I used for separating the different parts of the cell.
Were your parents supportive of the science approach? You said your father was a lawyer.
My parents had not the slightest interest in science. They're very nice people and very cultured people, but they were not interested in science. They allowed me tremendous freedom because, you know, at school I came home prizes without any problem, and so I was really free to develop the way I.
Yes. They were happy that you were achieving, you were being successful.
Right. So they were a little worried when I said I was going to become a scientist, because they wanted me to make a living, and they didn't see scientists as making a living. But I had some relatives. Part of my family is German, and because my grandfather on my mother's side was German. And in Germany, I had a number of cousins who were chemists, scientists, some of them quite famous. So there was a scientific part, side in the family.
And did you engage in discussions with these relatives in the science area or not?
Yes and no, because let us say by the time I really became interested in science, the war was imminent, or the war had broken out, and of course I had no contact with them during that time.
Was there anything in relationship to your situation during the war that in any way impacted on your future and how the direction you went? It doesn't seem, from what you said earlier, that there was any significant impact.
I don't know. You know, it's impossible to rewind the tape, as some say, and find out what would happen if something else, you know, had not been. And obviously, the war kept me a prisoner within the confines of Belgium. I was sort of forced by the war to find something to do there. And that probably helped me to go back to school and to do the chemistry, because I really was very much, I very much wanted to travel. I was always, when I was a child, I did travel in Europe. I spent holidays in England because my family had friends there, and I was born there. Spent holidays in Germany because I had part of my relatives there. Traveled in France and Sweden, Norway, and so I had done a fair amount of traveling, and you know, as a child, I considered myself a citizen of the world, you know, and so I was very much attracted. And the first thing I would have done, I think, after graduating, would have been to go abroad as a postdoc somewhere, and so I might never have had, let us say, the courage to to go back to school and spend another 4 years, if I might have just decided to develop, I would have learned biochemistry in a different way. I would still have become a biochemist. But perhaps I would not have courage to go through, you know, this, because learning chemistry, I mean, those were solid studies. I had to go learn again, I mean, physics, even theoretical physics and quantum mechanics and organic chemistry and thermodynamics and so on, physical chemistry. So I really had to get a grounding in basic science, which I think was tremendously useful to me. Because medical doctors, physicians, don't really get a strong training in basic sciences. You know, they get a sort of smattering, but really not the kind of ground training that I was able to enjoy that way.
What was the first serious research that you did? What would you, if you go back, what would be the first thing you did that you would consider to have been a really independent research effort? Was it?
Well, that goes back more than 60 years. Because when I was a student and started working in this physiology lab, I didn't say I was put, but there were several different projects going on, and I chose to join a project that was working on insulin. And so we were doing various experiments, which we don't want to go into the details, but led me to the conclusion that insulin exerted a very important effect on liver metabolism. So that was really, that was not a great discovery, except that I was in a minority, because the experts in the world believed otherwise. They believed that insulin had little or no effect on the liver, and this included some very famous people. And so I was a little uncertain. So I spent a lot of time reading those works and say, well, how, I'm sure I'm right. How can I, these are good scientists. How can I explain their results? And it was a mind problem, you see, because I looked at it and I said, well, knowing the literature, and said, there's no only one explanation. There's an impurity in the insulin that they use. Their insulin is impure and my insulin is pure. And so their insulin was the one made by Eli Lilly and company. So, and I knew what that impurity was because it had been described. I mean, I didn't discover it, but it was something that in the 20s had been described as a glucagon, which is a substance that acts just opposite insulin. It's really an antagonist of insulin, but it's also made in the pancreas. And early insulin samples contained this impurity. Then the impurity was eliminated by purification methods. And then the purification methods were changed, and the impurity came back, but nobody realized this, you see. And so I said there must be the glucagon in their insulin. By that time the war had broken out, so I could just write this as an explanation. But September 1944, the country was liberated, at least the city of Louvain, where the university was liberated by the American army. And so, not the next day, because I spent the first day celebrating, but the day after, I went to an American army camp, asked to see the doctor. I said, can you give me a couple of vials of Lilly insulin? And so he gave me. I went back to the lab and did a few experiments, and in a couple of days, I had verified the fact that the glucagon was indeed present in those. And so I wrote to the people in the States, and so I became a little famous. By that time, that was my first discovery.
And it would also then have also reinforced in your mind a pattern of work, of discipline. of rigorous attention to detail that then I assume just served you throughout.
Oh yes,
because that's quite an achievement at that youthful age. But to be determined enough to.
But I think what I did gain from my studies under the Jesuit fathers was an excellent training of the brain, reasoning. You know, they really teach you to reason rigorously. Maybe not in theology, but in philosophy, and especially rigorously in terms of analysis of use of words, analysis of sentences, and so on. So I did have training did help me, and it certainly helped me in writing books, for instance.
In Vital Dust, I was I had to smile when I read of your reference to the Nobel Prize. In the preface, you didn't mention the prize. You simply mentioned a disruptive trip to Stockholm in 1974.
It was disruptive.
And that was the point I wanted to ask. Yeah. And of course, the trip itself would be disruptive to anybody who has to take what could be 2 or 3 weeks of your life and et cetera, and preparing for it. But do you think that the Nobel Prize is disruptive in any other way in one's scientific work?
It's a complex issue. You know, they always ask that question, was your life changed by the Nobel Prize? And the answer to that is yes and no. You know, no, because I did continue working and doing research for a number of years, and I didn't change in that respect. But of course, my life was changed to some extent because, you know, I was somewhat in the limelight, at least for a couple of weeks. And I do get more invitations. You probably wouldn't have invited me here if I didn't have this label. And of course, it in a small country like Belgium, it probably has a little more, I wouldn't say glamour, but a little more prestige than in the United States. You know, in New York, every other person you meet in the street is a Nobel laureate, so that doesn't really carry much weight. But in Belgium, there are only 2 laureates alive, so that, and then we have only in the sciences, I think altogether, there were 4 in medicine and 1 in chemistry. So it's I'm one in a few. And what happened also was, this is something we may talk about later with, but what happened was that due to my association with Rockefeller and due to a number of other factors, I created a new institute in Belgium, which is a biomedical research institute, which is going on now. It's going strong. It's not very big. It has 300 people working in it. But anyway, it does basic and applied research of really high quality. And that happened to open its doors in 1974, just when the news came from Stockholm. And since I needed a lot of support, that was a heaven sent thing, obviously, because that made it possible at that time for me to raise some funds to start the institute. And it still helps me in raising funds for the institute. So in that respect, it's changed my life.
Mm-hmm. So there was some disruption in terms of normal routine and demands of media, et cetera. But in this case, you somewhat got a return from that.
Sure, sure. Yeah. No, it was it's a great thing. You know, when people tell you it didn't affect them, they're lying. I mean, when you get a prize, something like a Nobel Prize, you're very pleased.
You should be I think you should be proud of that. Recognizes a significant,
right.
Particularly those prizes that are in the sciences, because those come dearly.
Oh, yes. You're very pleased. Now, the problem, of course, I think something like the Nobel Prize is, it's very good for science, because it's, in spite of the fact that there are many other prizes, that prize sort of carries a special prestige in the general public, you know. And in that respect, it's good for science because it It's good for science because it helps making science known to the general public, appreciated by the general public. So that's fine. I think it's maybe not so good within the scientific community because it establishes some sort of a disparity, and a big one, between people who really are equal or almost equal. And so I think that perhaps is not so good.
Mm-hmm. Scholars, from what I understand, as a layman, but someone very interested in the world of ideas, but I have this sense that scholars generally stand on the shoulders of their predecessors in some way. Do you have someone that you look to as particularly important in terms of helping you take another step ahead in terms of science, someone that did research that you then built on?
No, that's a good question. I don't know who said it. Standing on the shoulders of giants, was it Newton or something? Never mind. When people ask you, well, what's the secret of success? I always answer, well, first, choose your parents well. But that's not easy. And the next thing is choose your teachers well. And this is particularly true in science, because science it's like the crafts in the Middle Ages. It's something, good research is something that you don't learn in books, and you don't self-teach it. It's something that you learn from a master, or from masters. And so you would always find that successful scientists have been trained, at least partly, by scientists who were themselves successful. And I happen to be particularly fortunate in this respect because four of my mentors are Nobel Prize laureates. I came to this country in 1947 to do postdoctoral work in St. Louis with Carl and Gertie Corey, who were great leaders in the field of insulin carbohydrate metabolism, so that's how I got there. And that year, while I was there, they received the Nobel Prize in Medicine jointly, man and wife. I was working in their lab with a young man called Earl Sutherland, who got the prize in 71. Before I had been in St. Louis, I worked in Stockholm for 18 months in the laboratory of a man called Hugo Theorel, who got the prize in medicine in 1955. So, of course, that's doesn't mean that all you need to get the Nobel Prize is to work under Nobel Prize winners. But in any case, this just illustrates to me the fact that, and this is the experience I had, I know that if I had not benefited from the training, and also my two mentors in Louvain in Belgium, they were not laureates. They had worked with laureates, actually, both of them. But they also helped me, train my mind, train my way of doing research. So I do think I owe everything to my mentors. I think you can have whatever gifts you may receive from heaven in science, if you don't get, at least that's my experience, if you don't get the training from really good scientists as to how to use your gifts, maybe you'll never get anywhere, or you'll do some sort of a wrong kind of science.
Are you impressed with the scholarship that's going on today? Do you feel there has been continuing improvement in the ability in the areas of science?
Well, I think we have to distinguish between science and scholarship. Most scientists are not scholars, and to be both is not easy. Many scholars are not scientists, and that shows. In many cases, that shows in their writings. But scientists that are at the same time scholars are rare, especially nowadays, because science requires an increasing specialization and technical and theoretical training, which doesn't leave much room for excursions outside. So I think, in biology, the leaders today are the molecular biologists. And I know a few of them, and a few are really scholars, but many of them are not, I would say.
Final question.
Final question.
And that's the one that comes very easy. What do you feel about the future? Are you optimistic about science and its ability to help mankind weather all the problems we seem to bring upon ourselves or encounter?
Well, that predicting the future is obviously not easy. It's a dangerous thing to attempt. I would say I'm a moderately pessimistic and moderately optimistic. Short term, mostly pessimistic. Long term, optimistic. But I think the problem with us is that our knowledge, our technologies, our abilities to manipulate nature have run ahead of our wisdom and our ability to make wise decisions. And therefore, unfortunately, we may, unless some miracle occurs, we may have to learn wisdom the hard way. That is, we have to learn it by way of natural selection and not by way of wise decision.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.